Welcome to the Firehouse Salon. My name's Ashley Polak.
And I'm James King.
And another episode for us to discover the madcap adventures of Howard Gossage and his Firehouse gang, and the adventures they got up to in the 60s and how that's relevant today. And today we're going to be exploring the world of Marshall McLuhan, and we're really happy and lucky to be speaking to his grandson, Andrew McLuhan, who runs the McLuhan Institute. Let's get started with a story that I heard many times from Howard's wonderful wife, Sally Kemp, about how Howard first discovered McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan was one of the people that Howard developed, really, because Marshall was a professor in Canada who had written a book that nobody understood. And I remember lying in bed, I was reading some sort of wonderful novel, and Howard was reading Marshall McLuhan's book. And he said, I get it, I understand it. I said, what? He said, people are talking about this book because they don't understand it. I understand that what it is that Marshall is assuming that the reader already knows all of the background stuff that Marshall knows. So he's writing in shorthand. It needs to be filled in. I'm going to fix it. And the next thing I know, we're in bed, it's late at night, and he's on the phone, and he's got Marshall McLuhan on the phone in Canada. And I remember he said, McLuhan, what are you doing? And apparently Marshall McLuhan said, I'm grading papers. Howard said, you want to be famous? And I don't know what McLuhan's response was, but Howard introduced himself on the phone and he said, I want you to meet us in New York at such and such a date. I'm going to see to it that you become famous. You will never have to grade papers again. Next thing I know, a few days later, we're in New York and he's got all the editors of New Yorker, Newsweek, everybody he knew in this party that we gave.
Gossage actually paid to fly McLuhan over to New York, arranged for several New York magazine editors to meet him in the Lombardi Hotel. And that meeting went so well that McLuhan ended up being offered the use of both Time and Newsweek's offices moving forwards. And then obviously Howard staged a festival of McLuhan in the Firehouses itself.
I do love with that festival. He staged this festival, but I think only about 12 people turned up. But it's like the important people turned up. Tom Wolfe was there and key journalists. And it reminds me somewhat of that famous Sex Pistols gig, this formative moment in punk culture. And everyone said they were there, but apparently there were only like 20 people.
The Ramparts magazine editors and the San Francisco Chronicle and a few ad executives. But obviously Tom Wolfe did, you know, write about it in his essay, What If He's Right?
Yeah. And what did he mean by what if he's right? I mean, what was McLuhan talking about? Why was it relevant at that point? Why did it catch the popular imagination?
At that particular moment in time, you know, one of the things he's most famous for is coining the phrase, the medium is the message, which was sort of the substance of understanding media. And the kind of short way around saying that is he was focused less on the importance of the content, but more on the medium itself as having its own characteristics. He describes the content of the medium as being like a juicy piece of meat carried in by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind.
Right.
Now, what Howard was very good at was taking meandering sentences that McLuhan would come up with like that and explaining them to people in much more simple ways. Howard was very good at explaining McLuhan to other people, being an academic, was rather verbose in the way that he described what was ultimately quite simple things. It's interesting to think about today, is the medium more important than the context in an era of misinformation and artificial intelligence? It is something that I've been reflecting a lot on recently. Does artificial intelligence kind of make the content at least less trustworthy than the medium?
And artificial intelligence is the topic of our next live salon on the 8th of February. Let's jump into the interview with Andrew. But before we do that, we're going to play a clip from a 1967 documentary.
Marshall McLuhan is a professor of English at the University of Toronto and director of its Centre for Culture and Technology. He's the author of several books and hundreds of articles whose sales increase daily. Suddenly, everybody, press, industry, corporations, and the new youth, have discovered him. And he has become a storm center of extreme controversy.
The ordinary child of our culture is being educated by the TV form into a state of participation in all sorts of sensuous operations that the old visual culture carefully refrained from and kept distant from.
I do believe he is a popularizer. I do believe in 5 years we will look back at this book and perhaps shrug our shoulders. I don't think it's of long or lasting influence.
Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be on the receiving end of the fire hose.
Thank you. So tell me a bit about your involvement with your grandfather's legacy.
Well, you've reached me in rural southern Ontario, close to the shore of Lake Ontario, about a two-hour drive east of Toronto. Toronto is where Marshall lived and worked for most of his life, where I was born and raised. But my parents decided to move out here to the country back just before the turn of the century. And I've kind of stayed here, not quite according to plan, but that's the way things go. So my parents converted this two-story barn. This is our firehouse, I guess, to be a library and archive and office. And this is where we're speaking now.
Obviously, Marshall is your grandfather. What was your relationship with him and how has that evolved to what you do today?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, all relationships to our family are funny and or fraught things depending on the time. But for me, it's kind of weird because Marshall, my grandfather, Marshall McLuhan, was quite well known for a time. He's not as well known these days, but back in the mid-1960s, late 1960s, he was a household name. And he died when I was just around 2 years old. So I didn't get to know him very well for very long. In fact, just after I was born, he had a major stroke, which removed his ability to communicate. So he couldn't talk. And so it was kind of when I was just learning to talk and he wasn't able to talk. And so apparently we would have these babbling kind of conversations, which I like to think were very meaningful, but who knows? So the relationship is odd because for most people, when you have a grandparent, a relative that dies when you're very young and you don't have active memories, you rely on the memories of other people. And sometimes if you're lucky, that's a nice handful of people who can tell you who that person was. But strangely enough, in my case, it's every person who seemed to have met him, even if it was for in an elevator, remembers and has a story about it. And that's different. Also, the internet being the internet, he's all over YouTube and a Google search will bring you millions of results. So it's a very different experience to get to know somebody. There's an added layer of complexity in my case with Marshall in that he was a public figure who very much developed and performed a public persona. So this is common today in the age that we live in, where people are very performative. But Marshall carefully crafted his public image and persona. However, and who he was in public was different from who he was in private. He didn't like to air his private opinions in public. It introduces an added layer of complexity because what isn't necessarily everything. So you have to kind of keep that in mind and it requires a bit of detective work, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense.
I set up the McLuhan Institute to continue McLuhan studies in the McLuhan tradition. So My grandfather was a pioneer of media studies in the 20th century, and he particularly developed a specific way of looking at the effects of technologies on individuals and cultures and various methods and means for doing that.
Give me a sense. So I'm someone listening to this who's never heard of Marshall McLuhan. So could you give me the kind of pitch of the impact his thinking had in the 60s? And then with what you're doing today, as I understand it, you're going and talking to people and giving lectures. Why is that thinking so important today?
That can be a long conversation, but What I think what struck people, why Marshall's approach was novel, is he put it like this, that conventional models of communication up to the time had to do with transportation. Okay, they were transportation theories. That is, I don't know if you've heard of Shannon Weaver, but the Shannon Weaver model of communication is the standard one where you have a signal, a source, and you have a channel through which that signal flows, and then you have a receiver on the end for transmitting messages. And the ideal for a channel is to reduce the noise so that the signal is received with as little noise or friction. But that doesn't take into account the effect on the user. So Marshall said that his model of communication was one of transformation over transportation. So he was interested in less in the content of media, of technologies, of communication, and more interested about the structure or the form and the effects of that. And he broke those effects down to two major parts, the individual or the personal, and the social or cultural or collective. So, for example, the effect of the telephone was sure to be able to allow us to speak over great distances, but the effect that it had on the world was much greater than the content of the communications that happened over it. Or the car, for example. The car made it possible for people to live further than they were able to walk to work, right? So it created suburbs and the idea of commuting, right? Which had a great effect on family life and community life, as well as work life. And these effects happened kind of beside to the point of whether you worked at the bread factory or whether you worked at Gossage's firehouse. The effect happened because of the structural nature of the form. It gets a little deeper than that.
One question on that, which fascinates me, because when you hear the medium is the message, it makes me think very much about media, newspapers or TV or the internet now. Yeah. But it's fascinating the examples you've just used there, the car and the way that's affected society. So is that the medium is the message?
That's the point I was about to make before you so rudely cut me off, Ash. Is that another major contribution Marshall made to communication studies was in fact enlarging the category from communication studies to media studies. So the point there being not just looking at the media of communication, but all human technologies is what he studied. In fact, it's a lot easier to understand something like the medium is the message when you look at something other than a communications media, like, for example, air conditioning, right? Air conditioning is a major human innovation, which completely revolutionized people's lives, not because of the content of air conditioning, but the structure and what it afforded and what it made possible. For example, air conditioning makes it possible to live year-round on the 20th floor of a building or the 40th floor. You can build a building more than a dozen floors with air conditioning, which you couldn't before. Or you can live in Florida or in Africa where you couldn't before. It's a lot easier to see the effects of the technology as creating an environment of services when you take away the ostensible content.
Yes. And so at the time, would I be right in saying he was often confused because people thought that he was telling them the way to think, but actually it was about asking questions they maybe hadn't thought of? Have I understood that correctly?
Sure. He was trying to, well, one of the major difficulties, he put it like this in Understanding Media, which was the book Howard Gossage came across and jumped on. He said, I'm in the position of Louis Pasteur trying to tell people that their greatest enemy is all around them unseen. Louis Pasteur was the guy who discovered the role of bacteria in disease and sickness and health, relatively. He's the guy that got surgeons to start washing their hands. Well, Marshall was trying to tell people about the difficult to perceive effects of technologies, because when we focus on the content level of things, we're missing 90% of the picture. So he was challenging people to, yeah, think differently.
So do you think, if we bring that up to today, was it an inevitable path that as human beings, we always just follow technology and the world that it opens up to us unwittingly?
At the time, and Marshall McLuhan first said the medium is a message in 1958, well before understanding media. And at the time, people said, what are you talking about? The message is the message. People thought he was crazy.
Yeah.
Today, I can give a little talk or a lecture on the medium is the message. And I can talk about air conditioning, for example, or the car, and how the structure of these technologies reshape us and society around them, and how that is the medium he was talking about. And that's why that is the primary message. And people are not like, you're crazy. They're like, well, yeah, obviously. So for me, as a child, it went over my head. 20 years later, I got a little bit more. 10 years after that, got a little bit more. I have a recording of Marshall in 1973 saying that, oh, I wish I could remember exactly. I'll have to go back and listen. But basically that he was 50 years ahead of his time. And I think that bears out.
Yeah. I mean, there was something about him and the way he wrote, with all honesty, on my bookshelf up there. I've got, I'm sure, Understanding Media and some of his other books, but I've also equally got books of people picking apart and helping explain the books, because they sometimes feel like almost they're purposely challenging you to figure it out, like some kind of puzzle. So the way you've just described things makes a lot of sense to me. But I wonder, did he kind of revel in people being a bit confused and leaning into that?
I'm not sure revel is the right word, because I think it was very frustrating, as you can imagine. It's very challenging to get people to see things differently than the way they're accustomed to. Very difficult. So how do you do that? The number one thing I suggest to people when they're reading McLuhan work, especially Understanding Media, is not to read it like a piece of nonfiction you just bought at the bookstore that was written today, but to treat it like a book of poems, an anthology of poetry. You're not going to sit down and try to read that anthology of English poetry cover to cover. You're crazy to. And nobody would do that, because they understand that's not how poetry works, right? A poem only works, only gives you as much as you put into it. But people are used to being kind of, I don't want to say spoon-fed, because I don't mean it in a mean way or anything. It's just that we're used to having things explained to us rather than discovering the meaning and significance for ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what Marshall and his work challenges us to do. So if you want to get anything from the work, I would suggest pick up Understanding Media and read a page, just like pretty much any page, and then read it again tomorrow, and then maybe read it again the next day. You will get so much more from it than if you just try to plow through, because Marshall actually carefully crafted that book to remove a lot of the connective tissue from it. It was a work that was actually based on a report he delivered in 1960 that he spent 4 years rewriting and rewriting to make it more poetic, more aphoristic, just right. So that you would be able to encounter it and complete the meaning for yourself. It's really kind of masterful in that way.
It's really fascinating that you say that, because trying to understand Marshall has been a key part of my journey in understanding Howard and the Firehouse. And I've often felt a bit stupid reading Marshall's work. Like, I don't get this. Like, the more, like reading War and Peace almost.
Well, this again is part of the problem. And that's not your problem in being stupid. It's your problem in your expectation that understanding should be instant. It never is. Very rarely do we get hit by a lightning bolt of instant understanding. Understanding yes. is usually a process. It's hard work. It's like looking at a poem or a painting. You don't yep. usually get it at first look. So why would you expect to?
And that's the writing, but equally, when we look on YouTube, and I'm going to cut in some clips into our interview here, there are certain phrases that he said. So is that kind of the point, that he said something that's like 30 seconds of, wow, that's the internet, or wow, that's, he's talking about stuff that happened 50 years later?
No. Marshall said, I'm very careful to only predict things which have already happened. He was commenting on his present. He was describing what he saw or perceived around him. Here's where that gets crazy and sometimes keeps me up at night. So if you take him at his word, and I take him at his word, at least in this, that he was describing his present, okay? And then you consider that people say he's describing the future. He's describing the internet. He's describing today. Okay. The thing that bothers and unsettles me a little bit is that if he's describing his present and it looks like our present to us, what aren't we seeing today? And the answer is everything. So the thing that is unsettling about that is, if he's describing his present, but that's 50 years ago, what's happening today that we're not seeing?
And so one example would be AI, for example.
Sure.
So yeah. What is going on underneath that, separate from people are talking about loss of jobs and a change in work? And but exactly. If Marshall was here now, he'd be 10 layers deeper.
Well, exactly. And it wouldn't make any more sense to us today than what he was saying made any sense in the 1960s.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. Gosh, so that last point shifts where I thought my questioning was going to go, which is, I need to process this. Because what I thought before was he was this sage who had predicted the future.
So the point remains, the thing about understanding media and why his work remains relevant today is he sought to understand media, to understand technology, human innovation as a category. Now, he did this using specifics, examples from the past and his present. But what he particularly looked for were ways that we could understand technology as a category. What we do when we innovate as humans, what it means, what it implies, what effects it has on us. And so I suggested you read Understanding Media as an anthology of poetry, but it's also a field guide. It's a guidebook in the same way that you might have a wildflower guide or a Birds of North America guide. Understanding Media is broken into two parts, part one and part two. And part one is seven chapters, which I consider the liberal arts of McLuhan. And it's seven specific ways or perspectives of looking at technology or human innovation. Part two is 26 chapters, and it's taking those instruments from part one and applying them to specific technologies. So clothing, housing, speech, print, television, taking all those tools and methods from part one and applying them. This is why work like that is timeless and relevant today, because a screwdriver is useful as long as you have screws. You don't build a screwdriver today and it's not useful tomorrow, right? A tool is useful as a tool. And that's where I focus in my work with the McLuhan Institute, is not on theory, but on what's practical, what is useful from that work from yesterday, and not get bogged down in what's not useful, because time's too short.
What that's making me think about is the event that we've held about the work of E.F. Schumacher and Small is Beautiful, and how the organization that he set up in the 1970s has evolved, and what they do now is apply the theories of this person rather than getting caught in the past of what he was saying. They're like, right, there's this philosophy. How can we apply that to affect change today?
That's my approach. Because again, museums are fun and interesting. Pastimes are pastimes. I think we're at a time in human history when we're so far ahead of ourselves that we don't have the luxury of time that we used to a long time ago. A long time ago, and we're talking hundreds of years ago, change happened so slowly that you could get used to it and you didn't notice it. Marshall liked to bring up, I forget who, Bertrand Russell, I think it was, who said that if you only raise the temperature of the bathwater by a degree every hour, you wouldn't know when to scream. So when technological progress, advance, whatever, happens so slowly, you have the ability to get used to it, but the inability to notice it. Where we are today is we're trying to step our foot in a tea kettle that's just boiled. And we burn ourselves constantly, but we don't understand. We don't make the connection that, oh, I just put my foot in a tea kettle. Might not want to do that. Because we have this very strange human inability to understand causality and why these things happen and what is happening. We just kind of blame it on, well, various weird things. But the point being that we're desperately in need of understanding the effects of technologies and maybe modifying our behavior when it comes to developing and implementing technologies.
It feels to me like there is stuff going on with the Earth now that requires that kind of 60s thinking again. Like, as you say, everything's sped up so much and now everything's happening so fast that actually digging deep and pausing, I think, is important.
I mean, look, we're deep in a transition period between technological ages, right? AI is quickly remaking everything in its image, in its structure. And because of that, yeah, everything is breaking down. But two things. For one, breakdown is breakthrough.
Yep.
And ending is beginning.
Yep.
I think we would be very smart to start to take that into account in our planning stages rather than just introduce technologies and hope for the best. I mean, that's beyond naive and toward irresponsibility at our global scale today.
Andrew, real pleasure. Thank you so much.
I always thought that Marshall McLuhan was this sage of the internet, the patron saint of the internet, as Wired magazine called him. He was on the front cover of their first edition. He's well known as being the guy who predicted an interconnected village of machines. He's one of those people that stuff comes out of his mouth and you're like, that sounds suspiciously like things that are very relevant today.
I mean, I guess one of the interesting things is he did very much predict this electronic interdependence, long-form communication that became the internet.
Global village is not created by the motor car or even by the airplane. It's created by instant electronic information movement. The global village is at once as wide as the planet and as small as a little town where everybody is maliciously engaged in poking his nose into everybody else's business. The global village is a world in which you don't necessarily have harmony. You have extreme concern with everybody else's business and much involvement in everybody else's life.
With a lot of McLuhan, he was viewing it as this would usher in a change in humankind away from this fragmented, individualistic world that they were living in the 60s, and he thought it would bring about a bit more of a collective identity with a tribal base.
Yes.
But I think that was a somewhat utopian view. The internet actually facilitated arguably a greater fragmentation and all these different tribal bases, and that's where we've seen incredible political discord in recent times, disparity in opinions, because suddenly everyone's voice was equal to an extent. Or at least people could cluster in corners of the internet on Reddit and chat rooms where people embolden their sort of their fringe views, so that there was no collective identity. If anything, it was more fragmented than ever.
Do you think there was a key point in this to do with the time? It's the 60s. McLuhan started writing about these theories in the 50s, but do you think there was something about popular culture at that time that you've got the environmental movement, the first images of Earth from space? Do you think it was timely? Do you think that's why it kind of accelerated into the popular culture as well?
You've got to think at the time of writing, understanding media was 1964. The medium is the mass art. The kind of best-selling follow-up book was 1967. This was a very optimistic and utopic time still. The war on Vietnam was in its infancy, and that sense of real cynicism that came after the Watergate scandal in America particularly, that sense of the very fabric of government being untrustworthy, that hadn't really set in yet. And so you see that in a huge amount of popular culture around science fiction, even the works of Buckminster Fuller. These are pretty optimistic views of the future. And there was this sense of humanity, the first pictures of Earth from space, humanity moving towards some kind of collective peace.
Yes.
And a, you know, dissolving of nationalism. And for a variety of reasons, things have gone the other way, not to be overly cynical.
But he also is a person, I mean, I've got in front of me The Medium is the Massage book, which is kind of interesting, as I understand the story on that. That was a typo, but he thought it was quite funny. He kind of liked this idea of playing with you a bit, of stopping and making you think rather than giving you the answers. So The Medium is the Massage, I'd encourage people to have a look at, because it's, you can dip your toe into that. Whereas understanding media, I found it really hard to get into. It's quite an assault on the senses, or the mind at the very least.
Yeah, although, I mean, even The Medium is the Massage, I was thinking about it, sort of talking about how different media's massage the sensorum, describes it. And that did make me think about how social media is engineered to be a continual release of dopamine hits on our brains.
Well, the title, The Medium is the Massage, is a teaser, a way of getting attention. There's a wonderful sign hanging on a Toronto junkyard which reads, "Help beautify junkyards. Throw something lovely away today." And this is a very effective way of getting people to notice a lot of things. And so the title is intended to draw attention to the fact that a medium is not something neutral. It does something to people. It takes hold of them, it roughs them up, it massages them, it bumps them around, and as it were, chiropractically. And the general roughing up that any society gets from a medium, especially a new medium, is what is intended to be indicated in that title.
The medium of our time, electric technology. Everything from the light bulb, to the telephone, to the computer, to jets, to nuclear energy, is changing everything. We are in the middle of a tremendous clash between the old and the new.
The medium does things to people, and they're always completely unaware of this. Don't really notice the new medium that is roughing them up. They think of the old medium because the old medium is always the content of the new medium, as movies tend to be the content of TV, and as books used to be the content, novels used to be the content of movies. And so every time a new medium arrives, the old medium is the content, and it is highly observable, highly noticeable. But the real roughing up and massaging is done by the new medium, and it is ignored.
The idea that television, computers, and the rest are just tools that we use for better or worse isn't true. The way you react to them...
So in a sense, it is an incredibly massaging medium.
Yes.
Even online gambling is designed in exactly the same way to give you these constant rushes of endorphins that cause an addiction. And so that, again, is a sort of arguably more cynical development of this technology. But I mean, McLuhan was always very careful never to actually place value judgments on technology.
Yes.
He was trying to do it from a sort of...
He's like an anthropologist of media, wasn't he? He was an observer. That's why I wonder in terms of the 60s, right? You've got LSD and the Summer of Love, and it was all about expanding your mind.
Perception is absolutely key to all of McLuhan's work. This was a time, and it was inescapable, certainly from the world of the firehouse, where people were indulging in substances that expanded the doors of perception, as Aldous Huxley said. It's an interesting connection, but I know McLuhan was dropping acid when he was writing Understanding Media.
I think people were dropping acid to try and keep up with him. James, thank you so much.